This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Health insurance is one example of a bill that's now stalled in Congress. The climate change bill is another. And my guest, journalist Jeff Goodell, says similar tactics have been used to block both pieces of legislation. He has an article in the January 21st edition of Rolling Stone about how big oil and big coal mounted an aggressive lobbying campaign to block progress on global warming legislation. A bill that includes cap and trade has been passed in the House, but legislation has been stalled in the Senate. Cap and trade is a system designed to limit the amount of greenhouse gases released in the air. Companies are issued permits for the amount of carbon they're allowed to release. If they exceed that limit, to compensate, they must buy a permit from a company or companies that are under their carbon emissions limit or invest in an offset, a project that curbs emissions. Senators John Kerry, Joe Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham have been working on a bill for several months that may or may not include cap and trade, though some experts are already writing the obituary for that part of the deal. Last night, in a State of the Union address, President Obama spoke briefly about the importance of comprehensive climate and energy legislation. My guest, Jeff Goodell, is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. He's the author of the book Big Coal and has a forthcoming book called How to Cool the Planet. Jeff Goodell, welcome back to Fresh Air. So what does the bill that the House passed look like? Give us a real, like, layperson's explanation of it.
Well, it's a first thing it does, the most important thing it does, is it sets up the architecture for what's called a cap-and-trade system. A cap-and-trade system is what worked for the acid rain program that reduced traditional smog pollutant and dealt with the problem of acid rain. It allows polluters to figure out their own way to cut emissions rather than mandating a particular kind of technology to reduce emissions, like a scrubber on a power plant or something like that, or rather than forcing them to give up coal or anything like that. It says to the companies, look, this is your targets. We're going to reduce emissions, in the case of the House bill, by 17% by 2020. And it's up to you to figure out how to do it. And you can do it by buying credits from other companies. You can do it by shutting down coal plants. You can do it by efficiency measures, whatever you want to do. It's a great free market kind of tool because it allows great flexibility to these companies. One of the great ironies, of course, is that the Republicans and some of the Democrats, not just the Republicans, but the industry who were trying to fight this, played up the idea that this was a cap and tax, they called it, that this was a kind of draconian government intervention, when in fact it was the embodiment of free market kind of idealism and using markets to solve the problem, which conservatives and industry should love, but in fact they didn't, and they did their best to torpedo it.
So there's permits that are given out by the government with a limited amount of greenhouse gases that can be released. So you can buy permits or sell permits, and theoretically that limits to a predefined amount the amount of carbon gases that are going to be released into the environment.
Right. And the beauty of a cap-and-trade system as opposed to, say, a carbon tax, which some people have advocated, is a cap says, here is what we are going to emit. We're going to emit X number of tons as a nation, and you as a company have this much that you can emit. And so we know how much is essentially being emitted. And then as politics and as science demands, we can raise or lower, probably lower those caps over time and begin to move away from fossil fuels and begin to put what it does is it puts a price on carbon dioxide emissions so that it levels the playing field with cleaner sources of energy. So if right now solar power is more expensive, obviously, than power from a coal-fired power plant, but if you factor in the cost of the greenhouse gas emissions that come from burning coal, it levels out the playing field somewhat and allows greater expansion of renewable energy sources.
Now, you write that last year the number of lobbyists devoted to climate change had soared by more than fivefold since 2003. The number rose to 2,810. Only 138 of those lobbyists were pushing for alternative energy. What are some of the arguments that you think were made to congressmen and senators against the climate change legislation?
Well, I think the key argument was obviously jobs, especially in coal country. There was a lot of talk about if you put this kind of cap on CO2 emissions, it's going to cost jobs, and you don't want to lose jobs in your district. there is the – from the electric power companies, there's always the – one of the old standards is the reliability argument, because there's nothing that terrifies any politician more than a blackout. And the argument can be made that, oh, boy, if we have to start retiring coal plants and things like that, I can't guarantee the reliability of the grid. And wouldn't it be tragic if in your district there was a brownout? And nothing will make a politician tremble more than that. And then there's simply, you know, the money issue. I mean, we have people here who are giving a lot of money to the congressmen who are involved in this. And when you give a lot of money, your voice is listened to.
A lobbyist giving money in return for a vote for or a vote against something, that's one thing. But, you know, arguing that this cap-and-trade bill will be bad for jobs or might lead to brownouts in your district, that's pretty scary and sounds like might be real legitimate concerns.
I mean, obviously, you can't generalize, but I don't think that obviously, in coal country, if you're talking about specific districts, it's going to have an impact on coal, for example. And you are going to have to think about what are coal miners going to do. But this is going to happen anyway. I mean, we are moving in this direction. We are moving out of the era of fossil fuels. We're moving towards the era of renewable energy. Everyone in the coal industry, I've reported on the coal industry for 10 years now, and they all know that this era is coming to an end, but it's all about delay, 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 another quarter, another year. Let me get another, you know, certain number of tons out of this mountain. Let me have my profits for this next quarter. It's about short-term thinking versus long-term thinking.
Now, in writing about how the energy lobby has tried to block cap-and-trade climate control legislation, you say the industry switched approaches, that instead of arguing that global warming isn't real, it tried to shift the fear from climate change to the specter of massive government intervention. What was the argument?
Well, the argument was that by passing cap-and-trade legislation, government is going to regulate CO2 emissions and that it's going to then have government intervention in every part of America's economic activity, not just burning coal at big power plants, but, you know, there was talk about they're going to regulate how you mow your lawn because your lawn mower, you know, emits CO2 if you have a gas engine. And you know, you're not going to put a quota on breathing and things like that. I mean, they really played up this idea that this is sort of Big Daddy coming in and trying to tell you how you can live your life. I mean, they were very good at calling this cap and tax, you know, raising the specter of big fees on your electric bill, price of gas going up several dollars. All of these studies have now been shown to be as sort of fraudulent as a lot of the early global warming studies that were funded by the industry and suggested that, you know, global warming was not happening, or if it was, it would be good for agriculture or things like that. All of this stuff now has been disproven for a decade. And it's the same kind of tactics with these economic fears.
Now, you write about stalling tactics and blocking tactics that Republicans used in the House and in the Senate. Let's start with the House. You talk about Republican Congressman Joe Barton of Texas, who is a former chair of the House Energy Committee, pledging to launch, quote, crafty, unquote, attacks on the climate bill, and comparing the Republican Party's battle plan to, quote, guerrilla warfare. So what were some of those tactics?
Oh, well, you know, all kinds of sort of internal congressional games. One of the funniest ones was before the vote on the committee, he promised to read the entire bill, which would, of course, take, you know, days and days and days.
It was about 900 pages.
Right, right. And the Democrats, to their credit, wittily agreed to this, but then they hired a speed reader, brought in a speed reader, and they were going to have this speed reader read it in about 3 hours or something. And it was actually a kind of one comical moment in the whole thing. And Barton, after the speed reader started the bill and read for about 5 minutes, Barton threw in the towel and said, okay, we can do the vote. But there was all kinds of tactics, like 400 amendments, you know, essentially nonsense amendments, trying to stall and slow this down. I mean, the whole idea behind this, the Republican strategy was to slow this down and to derail this because they knew that there was a lot going on with the health care. And most important, because you had this Copenhagen target at the end of the year in December of 2009. And if the House bill would have been passed more quickly, perhaps, and been a little tougher, and they hadn't been able to sort of water it down as much. It might have moved into the Senate, and there might have been a possibility that this could have gotten passed by the House and the Senate prior to Copenhagen, which would have changed the dynamics entirely for the climate summit.
No, it's not just Republicans who have tried to block progress on cap-and-trade climate control legislation. Some Democrats have done that as well. You say it's especially Democrats from energy states. So what are some of the things Democrats have tried to do to slow or stop the legislation?
Well, Democrats have, in a certain way, you could say the Democrats have been sort of more of a problem than the Republicans. I mean, the Republicans' opposition to this has been expected. The tricky part was, and still is, the Democrats, who many of them come from big coal and industrial states like Virginia and West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, all of these places, even Alaska, places like that, who are stalling this and who, in the case of the House bill, there was a lot of the effort from the Democrats was to try to get the coal industry to buy into this, that there was no way that this was going to get through without essentially the legislators from coal regions, or certainly a handful of legislators from the coal regions, signing on to this. So the Democratic role in that sense was to make this deal as sweet as possible for the coal industry, to make it in their economic benefit to not block the legislation. We have a political mood where it's going to be very difficult to move this kind of legislation right now. There will be a lot of attempts to position this for as a kind of green jobs legislation and clean energy legislation, which is all well and good. But there's a question of whether we can get...
You're talking about scaling the legislation down so that it emphasizes job-creating technologies rather than cap-and-trade?
Right, right. And there's a question about whether even the cap-and-trade part of this would be stripped out and maybe just a kind of green jobs legislation be pushed through, which would include subsidies for clean energy technology and things like that, and various other, perhaps a renewable portfolio standard, which would mandate a certain amount of clean energy from various sources on a timetable. But even that is very iffy right now. And the real difficulty with this is that if the Senate doesn't act on cap and trade this year, then the likelihood of any kind of international agreement, a kind of legally binding agreement, which pretty much everyone agrees is the way we're going to solve this problem. We're not going to solve this by sort of voluntary actions and by everyone sort of saying nice things and wishing each other well. I mean, we have to have a legally binding international agreement. And if the Senate doesn't pass it this year, we have to restart from zero.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican from Alaska, has offered a measure to strip the EPA of its power to regulate carbon emissions. What would this measure do?
Well, this is really an important move on her part, because the finding from the Supreme Court that greenhouse gases are actually a dangerous pollutant and that the EPA has the authority to regulate this pollutant is really important. And that decision came last year. And it was really the stick that got a lot of the energy industry to the table on cap and trade and got them engaged. Because if there's one thing that the fossil fuel industry does not want, is the EPA in their lives. They hate the regulatory structure of the EPA. They will basically do anything to keep the EPA out of global warming legislation. And so for a lot of people last year, there was this sense that, okay, look, this is going to happen. We may as well try to get this done the best way that we can, and that's cap and trade, and not let the EPA get involved. So now that cap and trade has been stalled and this legislation has been stalled, now the industry is giving Senator Murkowski a lot of money and attention and affection. So what Senator Murkowski would like to do is undermine the authority, take away the authority of the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions.
So we've been talking about legislation that is stalled in the Senate, that is focused around cap and trade. But it's not just the energy industry. It's not just Republican opponents and Democrats from energy states who oppose cap and trade. There are some environmentalists that think cap and trade really isn't going to be a very effective system. What's the environmentalist argument against cap and trade?
Well, the environmentalist argument is simply that it's a scheme to enrich Wall Street, that, you know, it's about creating what many people believe will be the largest market ever, that the size of the market that would be created globally by a large cap and trade system that, you know, we pass in the United States. The European Union already has one going. Presumably China would eventually get involved in this. That's the strength of it, is that it's essentially a global trading system that globally sets caps on CO2 and reduces them. But it's also an enormous market. And there are a lot of environmentalists believe that this is all about essentially Goldman Sachs and others wanting to take a few percentages of a penny off of each transaction and make a heck of a lot of money. And they look at what happened with the shenanigans on Wall Street last year, the difficulty in regulating this industry, the complexity of futures and derivatives and all that kind of a thing, and see it as a kind of giant Ponzi scheme that will make it look like we're doing something about global warming and about reducing emissions, but will in fact do nothing and just enrich Wall Street. And one of the most outspoken opponents to this is a man with a lot of credibility, which is NASA climate scientist Jim Hansen, who was the first and has been the most outspoken scientist to warn us about the dangers of global warming. And he's basically been on a kind of warpath saying, you know, cap and trade is a bad idea. We have to admit it now, and we have to think differently about this. And he advocates a kind of carbon tax that is a tax on fossil fuels essentially as they come out of the ground, which is then repaid back to citizens in a kind of refund, so there's no money that goes to the government. It just is a tax and then a dividend paid back. And it's a sort of fine idea in principle. The problem is that there's essentially zero political support in Washington for this kind of thing.
Why? Because it's a tax and people just hate taxes?
Right. I mean, it's political suicide to straightforwardly advocate for any kind of a tax, much less an energy tax. But also, one of the reasons that cap and trade has a lot of momentum on it is that, you know, you do have big, powerful interests like Wall Street wanting this to move forward. And that's a big part of the political engine that's driving this. And I also think it's really important to say that
really? So like there's a Wall Street lobby behind that's helping to push through cap and trade?
Absolutely. Oh, my. Yes, absolutely. They're a big part of the strength of this legislation. They would dearly love this to happen. Yes, this is the financial industry is perhaps the most eager to see this happen because it's just, you know, a creation of a giant new market. And there's no way they can be losers in this. This is a win-win-win for the financial industry.
Now, I interrupted you. You were about to add something.
Well, I think it's really important when you talk about the criticisms of the cap and trade legislation and the idea of a cap and trade as a tool to reduce emissions, there are lots of legitimate concerns, and it is absolutely legitimate to worry about the role that Wall Street will play. It's absolutely legitimate to worry about whether or not carbon offsets are real, whether people are actually counting CO2 accurately. There's many things, but it's also important to say that this can be done right, and that a well-functioning market works. And we know that. We are a market-based economy. And we know that although this is complex, it is a test of our kind of political will and political integrity to design a system that does function and that does not allow people to manipulate it, does not allow game-playing, profit-seeking, things like that. And I think that the history of these cap and trade programs has shown that, yes, there are problems in the beginning, as there are in all markets, and it's not going to be a flawless system. But over time, we know how to make markets work. And over time, this is the best, most flexible, least intrusive tool to dealing with this enormous problem that we face as human civilization.
Well, Jeff Goodell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jeff Goodell is a contributing editor of Rolling Stone, where his article on efforts to block climate control legislation was published. His book, How to Cool the Planet, is scheduled to be published this spring. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although many experts have written the obituary for cap and trade in the U.S., the European Union and several other developed countries, including Japan, countries which signed the Kyoto Protocol, already have a cap and trade system. My guest, journalist Mark Shapiro, has been investigating how the system is functioning and the new complicated regulatory system that's developed around it. He's also reported on how cap and trade has turned carbon trading into the fastest growing commodities market on Earth. Major financial institutions, including Goldman Sachs, Barclays, and Citibank, already have carbon trading desks in London. Mark Shapiro's article on cap-and-trade is in the February edition of Harper's. He's also written about cap-and-trade for Mother Jones and is reporting for Carbon Watch, a joint production of the PBS series Frontline and the Center for Investigative Reporting, where he's a senior correspondent. Mark Shapiro, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with a little recap. What is the basic premise of cap-and-trade?
So the basic idea behind cap and trade is that the government issues emission limits, limits on the amount of greenhouse gases that major industries can emit into the atmosphere. And then it permits companies, if they exceed those limits, to go and purchase an offset somewhere else. Now, what is an offset? An offset is something that basically is a project to reduce emissions in some other part of the world. Let me give you an example. You've got a major German utility, for example. Every year, they are issued an emission limit, literally a number, as to how many greenhouse gases they can emit into the atmosphere. They have a huge complex. This is actually called RWE, the biggest utility in Germany. And they have a complex in their headquarters, which literally gives them a reading every day as to how many emissions their utility is emitting. And every month, they have an exact reading of how far over their limit they're going. And so that company has to go out and buy these things called offsets, which are essentially investments in what are emission reduction projects somewhere else. So you've got a system called CAP, which is you establish the caps, the limits on emissions, and trade, meaning you can go obtain emission reduction somewhere else to allow you to continue polluting at home.
So what are some of the typical offsets in the system?
Well, you've got offsets that are kind of wind farms and solar panels. The way the system works now, which is the system that was established by the Kyoto Protocol, is a significant portion of these offsets can be obtained in developing countries. So you, if you're that utility, you can go to Brazil or China or India, and you can invest, say, in a hydropowered dam, or you can invest in a wind farm. Or you can invest in an operation like, for example, in Brazil, where there are huge amounts of biofuel. They're taking, you know, agricultural waste and they're turning that into a fuel, which is then replacing oil-based fuels in a particular factory in Brazil. So these things are actually happening all over the world. Wind, solar, biofuels, transformations of energy sources that are being utilized as these kind of offsets.
Okay, now say you have a factory and you're emitting too many greenhouse gases. You're exceeding your permit. I have a factory. I'm under the amount that my permit allows. Can we trade so that you can use what I have left over?
Yeah. Yeah, we could do a deal. So I'm utility X and you're utility Y. You're in Philadelphia. I'm in California. And I'm emitting too much. You're emitting under. And therefore, I would buy the gap between your emission limits and how far under you are. So let's say you're allowed 100 million tons of carbon dioxide a year. You come in at 90 million tons. I, on the other hand, am emitting 130 million tons. I need 30 million tons from somewhere because I have a 100 million ton limit. And I buy 10 from you, and then I go buy another 20 somewhere else, either in this country or somewhere else.
So the idea is globally it all balances out since people are trading in different parts of the world, like carbon emitters are buying offsets in other parts of the country or other parts of the world?
Well, that's the theory. Suddenly, actually, what's interesting is that the notion of greenhouse gases has suddenly given the world a startling realization that we actually are one planet, ecologically speaking. I mean, we've all known this kind of abstractly, and certainly it's not a new idea. But the idea of what greenhouse gases are doing to the atmosphere has jolted people into this awareness that if you are polluting into the atmosphere in the United States and you are you have the ability to reduce pollution in Brazil or India or China, then the overall balance into the atmosphere is reduced. We all share the same atmosphere. The pollution in Brazil is the same as the pollution in Philadelphia or Chicago.
Well, for the globe it is, but not if you're living in Philadelphia and that's where it's polluted.
Right.
You're still living in a place that's polluted, no matter how many offsets there are in Brazil.
Well, yes, exactly. I think, yes, I mean we all – you got to think abstractly, Terry. You got to think abstractly.
This all right. So who is already using this cap-and-trade system?
So this cap-and-trade system that I've described is being utilized at this very moment by the European Union, all 27 countries of the European Union, by Japan, and by several other developed countries, including New Zealand. And those, of course, are the countries which signed the Kyoto Protocol. Remember, this goes back to 1997. The Kyoto Protocol was signed. In 2001, the United States pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol. But what's left is that the countries that are in the Kyoto Protocol are now operating according to this what's called a cap-and-trade system. They're now deeply engaged in this idea of having emission limits on the one hand and the ability to purchase emission reductions somewhere else.
And the UN administers this?
The UN administers it. This is the United Nations, of course, oversaw the Kyoto Protocol. It's a United Nations agreement. And now the United Nations, for the first time in history, is in the business of regulating a commodity market because this thing called a carbon offset has been turned into a commodity.
Now, you write that the commodity market of these carbon offsets, it's the fastest growing commodity market in the world, with companies buying and selling carbon credits like pork bellies or silver. Would you explain what the market is and what people are actually buying and selling?
Yes. Well, this is what's fascinating is to think, number one, that carbon, this idea of a commodity that is based on an emission reduction promise, is now the fastest growing commodity on Earth. I mean, basically, this was a market that was essentially around zero in 2005. 2005, the kind of market mechanisms kicked into gear. And now it's a market of approaching more than $150 billion. Huge market. What is it that's being traded? Well, this is a commodity that's based on the idea that somewhere else in the world there is an emission reduction happening. The commodity of carbon is essentially a commodity that is totally dependent on the measurements. So you have a promise in, for example, a country like Brazil, where you are emitting methane from a pig farm. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. And you say you're going to be able to reduce the methane emissions from that pig farm. And you want to obtain money for that technology. So you establish a proposal and you send that proposal to the United Nations. You say, over the next 5 years, I'm going to reduce the emissions that otherwise would have happened by 5, 10, 15 million tons. And the United Nations then gives its stamp of approval to enable you to then go sell that offset to an industry somewhere in the world that needs to reduce its own emissions.
Wait, hang on. That's also speculative to me. So you're saying that Company A says that it has a plan to limit methane gas produced on a pig farm in Brazil. And they go to the UN for approval for this plan, and then they sell that as carbon offsets to another company?
Yes.
Nothing's happened yet. It's all speculative. Exactly.
This whole market is based on speculative promises. You have a commodity that's based on a promise. It's a promise to reduce emissions in the future. It's about how you measure this commodity. You have other commodities in the world, for example, pork bellies. If you're speculating on pork bellies right now, somewhere down the line in a month or a year or whenever your contract comes due, you're going to get delivered 20 tons of pork bellies. The same thing with silver. If you're going to go speculate in the silver market, at some point you're going to get delivery of silver, which you've purchased on the market. When it comes to carbon, what you get is not something you can hold in your hand, not something you can really even put in your pocket. What you get is a certificate that promises X amount of emission reductions over the next several years. And it's these certificates that are now becoming the hottest commodity in the world right now.
Why are they the hottest commodity in the world?
Well, they're the hottest commodity for two reasons. One, you have most of the developed world now operating under this cap and trade system, which means you've got hundreds of billions of dollars in search of offsets because you've got major industries in all these different countries searching for offsets somewhere in the world to offset their emissions. And at the same time, what you've got is a very lively secondary market. These packages of carbon promises are now being speculated upon also in a secondary market, which is essentially a derivatives market, where people are betting essentially on the price of carbon, very much like they bet on the mortgage derivatives and things like that, on the price that this commodity would reach. That is now becoming a very lively area for speculation. The reason why perhaps many Americans may not be so aware of this enormous economy is that it's been largely headquartered in London. London is now the center of this international carbon trade, largely because the United States pulled out of Kyoto. In fact, I've talked to many people who are in the financial markets here in the United States, and in addition to disappointing many environmentalists, the Bush administration's decision to withdraw from Kyoto also disappointed many financial people, I can assure you, who had anticipated that this carbon market would be centered here in the United States.
Well, a lot of financial institutions with very familiar names have carbon trading desks in London now, right, including Goldman Sachs and Citigroup.
Exactly. What's happened now, this economy has become such a huge enterprise that some of the major American financial houses like Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan, which is also an owner of one of the biggest carbon brokerage firms, Bank of America, they all have carbon trading desks in London. If you go to downtown London, you'll see basically it's a concentrated area of carbon brokers and carbon traders. So the big American financial houses are certainly seeing this market and very much looking forward to this market essentially coming to the United States.
So explain to me a little bit more how investors make money on carbon trading.
Well, if you are a business and you need carbon offsets to meet your emission limits, well, you're going to go to Company B and try to buy those offsets, or you're going to go to a investment house that controls a whole group of offsets. They're sold in huge bundles, essentially, of like a million tons each. And you will go to a house, sometimes it actually could even be J.P. Morgan or one of these houses, and you will go buy a million tons. Now, if you're also a speculator, you're going to speculate on that price. So, for example, the price of carbon now in London is somewhere around $20. But you can also buy these bundles of carbon offsets at, let's say, $20 right now, and you can put them in your pocket and hope that that price is at some point going to go up to, let's say, $22. And then you're going to sell it on the market either to another speculator or to a business that needs those emission offsets. So a lot of people are actually making quite a bit of money now speculating on carbon. It's a pretty liquid market, and it's growing rapidly.
I could see how that would be very helpful. I could see how that would be kind of scary in the way that real estate became really scary when the derivatives started to plummet in price and the whole market crashed.
Well, there are people who see the parallels between the carbon markets and the derivatives markets. And this is the reason why. If you unpack these derivative bundles, let's say a million tons each, but each of these bundles are based on multiple different projects. It could be a methane reduction project in Brazil. It could be a dam in India. It could be a windmill farm in China, all bundled together into the same package to make up a million tons. And then that is now bought and sold and traded very much like a pork belly. But if you begin to unpack what is actually contained in those bundles, they all have various levels of reliability, various means of measurement, various means of predictability. When you say that somebody's going to deliver X amount of emission credits, there are very different calculations when it comes to a methane reduction plant than a wind farm, than a solar panel complex. And so there's a great deal of concern about the sort of reliability of the valuation of these carbon bundles. And what I write about is a whole new array of companies that have been certified by the United Nations to do those measurements.
Well, you're right that validation is the Achilles heel of the whole cap and trade system. Is that because of what you're saying, that you're measuring a promise?
Yes, you're actually, think of it this way, you're measuring a promise, you're measuring like a sequence of proposed facts that are going to happen. So you have a company that runs a pig iron factory in Brazil, and that company used to use oil to fire up its pig iron factory. So what it proposes to the UN is that, all right, instead of using oil, we're going to plant a bunch of trees, and we're going to then let those trees grow 7, 8, 9 years. In the process, while they're growing, they're actually soaking up carbon from the soil. Then we're going to burn those trees, and we're going to turn them into charcoal. And then they're taking that charcoal and bringing it to the pig iron factory, and instead of using oil, they use charcoal to fire up the pig iron factory. So at several stages along the way, the company claims that they are reducing emissions because basically, all right, so your trees are standing now and you claim that they're capturing X amount of carbon from the atmosphere. What's that going to look like in 5 years? Somebody comes out and measures that. The same thing happens with the pig iron factory. Well, you used to use oil and now you're using charcoal. Let's see how much emissions you're going to reduce over the next 5, 10, 15 years. Once you get approval for these promises, so the developer says, okay, we're going to reduce emissions by 5 million tons. Then a company comes in, and the United Nations has certified a group of companies to basically do the audits of these promises. They're called designated operational entities. I don't want to blur you with a million UN acronyms, but let's call them validators. They're brought in to validate the claims of people who are offsetting emissions, who claim to be offsetting emissions. These guys do the measurements. They are the Standard & Poor's, the way that Standard & Poor's and Moody's operate on Wall Street to establish the valuation of a company. These companies do the same thing for carbon.
Now, a couple of these companies that are validators, they were found to have done very inaccurate validations, sending the system kind of into a tizzy, yes?
Yes, that totally threw a wrench into the system because, you know, you're talking here about the two major validators who together are responsible for more than half of the offset emissions in the world. Well, imagine that half of the offsets that are claiming emission reductions. The United Nations suddenly found that basically two of the biggest companies had inadequate abilities to oversee their own work. Their people did not have the technical skills to even be conducting these analysis. And they found a great deal of discrepancy even within their own paperwork and even within their own analyses as to the legitimacy of these emission claims. So when this happened, it was like an earthquake going through the system, because suddenly all these hundreds of millions of tons that were being bought and sold were called into question.
So this calls into question two fundamental things. One is, are the carbon offsets that are being claimed accurate? Are we really limiting the amount of carbon through this cap and trade system? And it also calls into question, what about the whole carbon trading market? What happens to all the derivatives based on these invalid claims?
Right. And number one, both of these companies have since been reinstated by the United Nations after cleaning up their act and actually imposing much more stringent quality controls. They were reaccepted into the United Nations system. But what's still critical is that all the offsets that they had validated under these conditions that the United Nations itself found were flawed are still being bought and sold on the international carbon markets. And I think this calls into question, really, essentially the central claim of cap and trade, which is that all this money flowing into the system, you know, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, will actually result in the emission reductions that people think. This is why I wanted to look into this system, because if you have a market that has two rationales, one is to function as a market, and as a market, it's basically functioning fairly well. It's certainly making people profits and doing what a market's supposed to do. But the second question, is that market resulting in emission reductions? And I think there are some questions about that claim, which is, of course, its whole raison d'etre.
Now, the alternative to cap and trade that's been proposed is a carbon tax, and this is the alternative that's seen as a political impossibility, and that would be taxing companies that emit greenhouse gases for the taxing them based on the amount of greenhouse gases they emit. And that's unlikely to pass any time in the near future in the U.S. So that's basically been written off, right?
Well, that's what's I think that politically speaking, I think you're probably right. I think the carbon tax has been written off. But what I think is interesting to think about is if you were to have a cap and trade system, for example, that actually had the serious oversight, the monitoring of these transactions, a system which provided a much higher level of guarantees that the emission production promises were actually delivered. Number one, you could actually have a functioning cap and trade system in that case. And in that case, ironically, you would end up essentially with a carbon tax because to do that is expensive. It is expensive to have a monitoring system, a regulatory system with teeth is a commitment of resources. And so in order to have those resources and to have that kind of inspection that's going to guarantee the emission reductions promised or the emission reductions delivered, you essentially could end up with a carbon tax. So this whole elaborate system, which I've tried to evoke, was created to detour a carbon tax. And the irony, I think, is that if you were to actually have this whole system working with the effectiveness that is claimed, you would in some ways end up with a carbon tax.
If you're emitting too much carbon and you need some offsets, do you hire somebody to find you a project that you could use as offsets?
Yeah. That's what the carbon brokers are. Carbon brokers essentially are the intermediaries between the project in the developing world that's promising to reduce emissions and the company that needs emission reduction. So you have these carbon brokers. And carbon brokers are essentially the middlemen. And these are now becoming huge businesses. Goldman Sachs has a carbon brokerage firm. J.P. Morgan has a carbon brokerage firm, as well as many other kind of more boutique operations. But yes, you would go to a carbon broker.
So when you say that a carbon tax is not that different from cap and trade, the way it's practiced in the European Union, is this the kind of thing that you mean, that you have to like pay a broker to match you up with a project that has offsets? So you're paying money right there, and who knows what other expenses come down the line.
Yes. Well, there's an enormous amount of kind of middlemen in between this whole system, from the project on the ground to you ultimately getting your offset, and the ability to assure that the emission reductions you think you're buying are actually being delivered requires a level of oversight that is significantly greater than what seems to exist right now. Economists say that the carbon tax would actually be more efficient because it cuts out all these middlemen and it just establishes a simple penalty which would have to be paid over an emission at a certain level. It would clarify the measurements are far easier to conduct. The means by which you would assess that penalty is far easier to conduct. And so many economists say it would be far more efficient. But politically, it's, of course, another question.
But the thing with a carbon tax is it doesn't limit the emissions. It just means you pay to have extra.
Yes, you pay to have extra, but it creates a powerful disincentive. If you create enough of a cost for the tax, you're going to have a powerful incentive to institute renewable energy technology that would lower your tax.
Got it. Now, earlier on our show, journalist Jeff Goodell said, the carbon tax is a real political no-go in the U.S. And the European Union has shown that the system they're using for cap and trade works. There is a workable system. Would you describe that system as an efficient working system?
I would say the European system works to some extent. Certainly as a market, it's been working very well. And there have been small levels of emission reductions that have been accomplished in Europe, partly through this system, as well as partly through a whole series of subsidies to renewable energy technologies and such like that. And so on the one hand, you have a functioning market. On the other hand, you do have some levels of emission reductions that have happened. The question, though, that's raised about the European system is, are you getting the emission reductions you think when you're buying them? So there's an enormous amount of study has gone into this question of promising an emission reduction. And what they've concluded really over and over again is anywhere from a 15% to 35% overestimation as to how many emission reductions you're actually getting, which means you're getting far less of the emission reductions than you think in that market.
So you're getting emissions reductions, but not as much as you think.
Exactly. You're getting emission reductions, but not nearly as much as you think you are.
Well, Mark Shapiro, thank you for describing a very complicated system that we should probably all know something about. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hope it becomes clear now.
Mark Shapiro's article on cap and trade is in the February edition of Harper's. He's a senior correspondent for the Center for Investigative Reporting, which is jointly producing the Carbon Watch Project with the PBS series Frontline. I'm Terry Gross.